from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. Barracuda Networks, innovators of hybrid on-premises and virtual solutions for content security, network optimization, and data storage, benefiting more than 100,000 organizations worldwide. Barracuda.com. And the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up on this 7th anniversary of the Iraq invasion, teenage girls from across the state meet to talk about life with family deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a Vietnam War widow shares her story of loss, making sense of losing a young husband in an unpopular war.
As a survivor of that war, I felt shame too. Like, wait a minute, my husband died in a war that we lost? How do I figure this out? How do I make sense of this loss?
And making ends meet in the era of recession and budget cuts.
And these safety net programs, which have been shredded over the years, are all that many of these families have between absolute destitution and some minimum basic standard of living for their kids.
It's the California Report. This weekend does mark the 7th anniversary of the U.S. war in Iraq, and so we begin today with two stories about war and how it affects families, not just during the conflict, but sometimes long after the fighting ends. Last weekend, more than 100 teenage girls from across the state gathered for the first time to talk about their experiences as sisters and daughters in military families. Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca has their stories.
I'm Katie Knapp, and I'm 13 years old, and I'm in 7th grade. Like, maybe a year ago, my dad deployed to Iraq. I tried to help my mom with the dishes and all the chores, and when she was upset, I tried to comfort her. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
My name's Akayla, and I'm from Fairfield area, and I'm 15 years old. My brother, like, grew a lot while he was gone. Like, he started talking a lot more, and he learned how to do sentences, and so my dad missed all that.
I'm Vita Frumkin, and I am 17 and from Monterey. You won't see me graduate high school, which is a big, big moment in your life.
I'm Alicia Cancino. I'm from Monrovia, California, and I'm 16. Because they're like, you never know if they're going to come back or not, or in one piece. If anything, that's just really scary. It's like your own horror movie right in front of you in real life.
They call themselves the Sisterhood of the Traveling BDUs for battle dress uniforms. Last weekend, they boarded buses from across California, ending up at a veterans hall in Clovis, near Fresno. The teens were exhausted after a 5:30 a.m. wake-up call, military style. But they seemed to perk up, even stopped texting and giggling, when the two 17-year-old girls who organized the gathering took the stage. When they first met 2 years ago, Kaylee Deacon had a blue mohawk, while Miranda Hearn sported a more conservative look with accessories like charm bracelets.
We are complete opposites. I don't think that in any other arena we would have been friends. I thought that when my dad was deployed that I was the only one who was having any hard time. I thought I was just kind of like this weird person who couldn't get it together.
Kaylee talked to Miranda about fighting with her mom while her dad was away in Afghanistan. When he came home again, she had to get used to that too.
I really just was crazy because he was telling me no, I couldn't do the stuff that I was doing beforehand. And I was like, really? And he was like, you might be old, but you're not old enough to still do that. And when also he came home, I had a boyfriend. He was like, boyfriend's got to go.
Kaylee and Miranda say their connection made them realize teen girls with family members in the military needed a forum of their own. They created a PowerPoint presentation to convince the California National Guard and corporate sponsors to support the idea. The high school girls raised $30,000 to bring more than 100 teens to the conference, all expenses paid. The event kicked off with a masquerade ball, the girls parading down a purple carpet in fancy dresses. Miranda explains.
We want the girls walking the purple carpet right now to know that it may be hard, but you're special because your parent is in the military.
The girls heard from an Olympic soccer player and a Hollywood executive and attended sessions on self-esteem.
So what is self-esteem? Anybody? What's self-esteem? Yes?
How you feel about yourself and the way that you carry yourself.
I love that. The way you feel about yourself. And do you think self-esteem is something you're kind of born with?
No.
No?
The teens were also rallied by the first African-American woman to head the California National Guard, Brigadier General Mary Kite.
You are worthy of the future. You are worthy of our time. All of you are worthy of this. So realize
18-year-old Tiffany Fisher welcomed that message. Her dad first deployed when she was 13.
I said I was prepared for it, but the day he left, I cried like the whole day. The whole day. He wasn't even gone yet, and I was already crying. Because I used to be really, really close to him.
Tiffany says the most nerve-wracking moments came when her father was serving in Iraq, and the family heard he had been shot.
And we didn't know if he got killed. We didn't know, like, anything. We just knew he got shot. And so that during that 3 weeks, it was hard. My mom cried every night. We all cried, and I can't see my mom cry, so it made me cry.
Her father survived and is home, although she says he has a bullet still lodged in his leg. Lots of girls at the conference shared their fears that something could happen to their parents in combat. 16-year-old Alexandria Gonzalez.
And for me, because I'm a daddy's girl, so it's like I'm like super close to my dad. Like I would never want nothing to happen. Because if he died, I think I would die too.
Alexandria says it's comforting to meet other girls in her shoes.
I'm going to have a different state of mind of like there is other kids out there going through the same thing as me and my brother and sister are. Like, I didn't really think there was really anybody else, but there is.
Alexandria plans to join the Army, too.
Going through what my dad went through, just seeing what it's all, what's really out there. Because you don't know what they go through. They see people dying all the time. You don't know that feeling.
Ironically, her dad is retiring from the Army and will likely be home when his daughter is deployed. In fact, many of the girls say they plan to join the military, including the two conference organizers. Kaylee Deacon is enlisting in the Marines. Miranda Hearn has been accepted at the Air Force Academy. She says she hopes other teen girls will keep the sisterhood alive.
And that the next time a deployment rolls around, they will be supported and they have a network and it won't have to be the way it's always been.
The California teens plan to go national with the Sisterhood of the Traveling BDUs, creating chapters in other states by next year. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Clovis.
And to see photos from the conference and to learn more about the Sisterhood of the Traveling BDUs, visit our website, californiareport.org. Nearly 600 men and women from California have died in Iraq and Afghanistan since those wars began, and each loss has a profound and lasting effect on their families and friends. Over the past few months, I've spent time talking with military family members about the death of loved ones in the current wars. Sisters, wives, mothers, and fathers, each uniquely affected by their loss. Next week, we'll hear from some of them. But first, a widow who lost her husband in another war and still deals with that grief 4 decades later.
We were dating. He had a Ford Fairlane convertible.
I have a whole album I can show you if you want me to go get that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I'll be right back.
Sitting in the living room of her home in Santa Rosa, Pauline Laurent leafs through a scrapbook full of old newspaper clippings and Polaroid photos.
Here's a picture of when we were engaged, our wedding picture that was in the paper, my engagement picture. Here's some letters that he wrote me when we were dating. I kept all those letters.
Pauline Laurent met Howard Querry at a bank in Chicago where they both worked. It was 1965. As the Vietnam War heated up, Querry tried and failed to get a college deferment. He enlisted instead. 2 years later, they were married. She was soon pregnant, and her husband, now a sergeant in the Army, shipped out to Vietnam from Fort Ord.
I got married. I'm pregnant. He's going to Vietnam. This is not what I signed up for.
At the time, Pauline was living with her parents in Illinois. She wrote to her husband every day and followed news about the war. Then, one day, in May of 1968, she came across an article in the Sunday paper.
It mentioned my husband's unit, his company, his infantry division, you know, right down to the company A. And I was just stunned. And it said that there had been some people killed and, you know, the action was really heavy. They were in Saigon. And I instinctively knew that my husband was dead.
5 days later, her intuition was confirmed. She got the visit every military family dreads.
When I saw the Army car drive up, I told my mom, I said, see, here they are. They're coming to tell me that he died.
It took 3 weeks for Howard Querry's body to return home from Vietnam.
When I went up there, the funeral director said, we cannot open this coffin. And I said, why not? And he said, it's marked non-viewable. And that's all I was told.
She never did see her husband's body, and that let her hope that he wasn't really dead, that it was all a big mistake. Only decades later would she learn why the body was unviewable. Meanwhile, she started planning the funeral and just shut down emotionally to get through it.
Because everybody said, you can't cry, you're pregnant, you got to take care of that baby, you got to sleep, you got to eat, you can't cry.
Like all war widows, she received a letter from the president. It was meant to comfort her. However,
you know, Lyndon Johnson says, I pray that your pride and your husband's dedication to freedom will give you strength at this time. It took me a long time to realize that statement really doesn't allow you to grieve, because for me, I felt like I had to be just as heroic as my husband was. And when I'm being heroic, I can't grieve.
Within a year of being married, Pauline Laurent was now a widow. And within a few weeks of losing her husband, she'd become a new mother. In the months and years to come, Pauline took the love and affection she felt for him and threw it into raising their daughter, Michelle. However, as she later learned, it came at the expense of dealing with her own emotional loss.
It's nearly impossible to do the intense grief work when you have small children that you're responsible for, because then it's all about the kids. And a mother's life is all about taking care of her children, necessarily so. And it wasn't until my daughter was grown and married that I could really allow myself to fall apart.
Decades later, Pauline was still emotionally distraught. At age 45, she says she lost her will to live, even planning her own suicide.
Living with that emotional pain was really hard. I started therapy. I started healing. I started writing. Writing became the container that could hold my grief.
She realized that in order to move ahead with her life, she had to go back to learn more about her husband's death in Vietnam.
When I started my grieving process 25 years later, I started searching for the men who were with my husband when he died, and I found out why I couldn't view the body. They were with him, and they said that the fighting was so intense that they couldn't take his body out that day, so they didn't recover his body until the following morning. And by that time, the body had started to deteriorate, and that's why I couldn't view it.
Right after her husband died, Pauline received a box with his personal belongings. Every time she moved, she'd open it up. She'd look at the photos of her and of him in Vietnam.
But the most important thing I found was his wedding ring. And when I found his wedding ring, I knew that he was really dead. It was one of those moments of, you know, look, this was not a mistake. This was your husband. He died, and here's his wedding ring.
Pauline's husband, Howard, died in a war that was increasingly unpopular in the U.S., and she says, like the vets who came home to angry protests, she felt isolated. In fact, in that pre-internet age, it was 25 years until she met another Vietnam widow.
As a survivor of that war, I felt shame, too. Like, wait a minute, my husband died in a war that we lost? How do I figure this out? How do I make sense of this loss? How do I avoid being bitter and angry?
It's been more than 4 decades since Howard Querry died in Vietnam. Today, Pauline calls his death the foundation upon which her life is built.
I have never remarried. I think that says a lot right there. I have never allowed my heart to open up the way that it was open then, you know? I feel so sad many times that I never had the happy married life that I thought I was going to have when I married this man.
Pauline Laurent channeled her grief into helping others. Today, she counsels a new generation of war widows women who lost their husbands in Iraq and Afghanistan. Next week, we'll hear from some of those military families coping with loss in these current wars. To see a photo of Pauline Laurent, visit our website, californiareport.org. More than 11 million Californians live in households struggling to put food on the table. Today, we have the first of three stories in our series, Hunger in the Golden State. The six-month investigation was produced in collaboration with California Watch and the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. In our first report, Sandy Tolan finds hunger crossing the typical economic boundaries.
The workers at the Saddleback Church food pantry can hardly believe their good fortune. A semi-truck is backing into their loading dock with four dozen pallets of breakfast cereals.
Get out! 48?
This is awesome!
Hard times helped build this food pantry. A year ago, it didn't exist. In February, it fed 400 Orange County families. The Saddleback pantry is part of a vast network that gave out 300 million pounds of food to hungry Californians last year. It's hard to tell sometimes who's giving the charity and who's receiving it.
All of these are August.
Today, Kimberly Peterson is an Orange County housewife volunteering to sort boxes of toasted oats.
All of these cereals over here. Okay.
But once a month, despite her apparent wealth,
5-bedroom, 4-bath house, 3,200 square feet,
she's at the front door of the pantry waiting for free food.
I mean, how we've lived 2.5 years in one of the most expensive developments in Southern California with no income. We're not quite sure.
Her husband is an ex-realtor trying to start over by selling medical inventions. Kimberly homeschools her kids, so she doesn't have a paying job either.
Just through God that we've been able to come up with the money, the little money we had in savings or the 401ks or gifts from family and friends, we've been able to survive.
At home, the toilet is busted, panels are falling off, and the money they borrowed against the house is running out. Kimberly says they may lose their home this summer.
So it's really humbled us living in rich South Orange County, wherever they think everybody is, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, with a big house, driving Mercedes around. No, not a lot of people are hurt. And little do you know, because we all walk around with masks on our face, with a smile, thinking everything's okay, and it's not.
It's not okay all over California. Food banks report a sharp rise in demand, more than 30% just in the last year. In Fresno, emergency food workers gave out 6 million pounds in 2008, 14 million last year, and expect to dole out 30 million pounds this year. County officials across the state say the lines for food stamps and other help are going out the door and around the block.
In all my time here, I've never seen both the numbers of people coming in looking for assistance and also who's coming in.
Kathy Grahams began working for the Department of Social Services in rural Butte County 31 years ago. Now she's the director.
People that have never, ever come in through our doors before, in terms of more middle class, those with, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of solid job history, that just now have exhausted all their opportunity and are coming in for the first time.
And they're going in record numbers to the monthly giveaways of USDA commodities, like here in Chico, where the supply is not keeping up with the demand.
I run out of stew, and she ran out of peanut butter. Out of cheese, too. That's it.
In some parts of the state, food bank officials report that people are regularly being turned away, empty-handed.
We're out of everything. Now you mixed out on the stew and the apricots, the mixed fruit, and milk, I think.
As the food lines grow longer, the cash-poor state is proposing a new round of budget cuts.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's nice to see so many people here today.
Citizens packed a Sacramento hearing room last month to oppose cuts to CalWORKs, the state's welfare-to-work program that provides cash assistance to poor families.
We help 2,000 to 3,000 CalWORKS parents every year get into job training and education programs so they can break the cycle and be taxpayers and never need assistance again.
Supporters say these programs form a vital safety net against personal catastrophe.
I'm a single mother or two, and I just wanted to say that if you cut off our aid, we will be homeless, our kids will be homeless, and we will be hungry.
The State Department of Social Services is calling for a 16% cut to monthly grants to CalWORKS families. They'd max out at $585 a month. Officials say their proposals would protect the most vulnerable, but state officials declined repeated requests to talk about the potential impact of these cuts.
Everyone in our society is close to being on the edge.
Standing outside the hearing room, Frank Mecca is more than willing to talk. He runs the County Welfare Directors Association of California.
And these safety net programs, which have been shredded over the years, are all that many of these families have between absolute destitution and some minimum basic standard of living for their kids.
Hi. Tracy, nice to meet you.
This is my daughter, Sunny.
Tracy Stogsdill lives with her boyfriend and three kids in Esplanade House, a Chico shelter, a nice one that looks more like a two-bedroom apartment. Families here get money from CalWORKS.
That was school, baby.
It was okay.
The help Tracy gets with rent here means she can focus on looking for work and putting food on the table.
We're lucky to have been poor all our lives. We know how to do it. We know how to stretch a bag of beans and a bag of rice to make it feed us for a week and still smile, you know?
Tracy says she feels bad for all the people who suddenly need to figure out the system in order to feed their families.
There's people who were in a place of not having to worry about where their meals were coming from, all of a sudden having to figure out how to get a food box, not knowing what a food stamp is. With our economy, all these people who are losing their homes, losing their vehicles, and when you don't have the dollar for the grocery store, how do you get food?
I'd like you to alternate between the large canister of oatmeal and then the box of cold cereal.
I helped a woman who, when I took her food out, I thought, wow, that's a really nice car. She had a Lexus, a big Lexus.
Back in Orange County, Raina Muncy of the Saddleback Church Food Pantry tells an increasingly familiar story.
So as I loaded her food in and I was talking with her, I noticed she had a bunch of things inside of her car. She was living in her car. She had lost her job, blown through her severance pay, was unable to make her mortgage, and so she was basically waiting for them to repossess her car. And at that point, she would become homeless.
A Saddleback volunteer pushes a food cart out to the parking lot and joins hands with a young couple. They bow their heads.
Oh, precious Jesus, thank you so much for bringing Lorraine into our food pantry today. What an honor and a privilege it is to serve her family.
Lorraine and Armando Rios, both out of work, recently had to move their family of five into their master bedroom so they could get a little rental income. Every week, they're on the lookout for free food.
We know so many people who are struggling right now, Jesus, but we just ask, Lord, that you would wrap your arms around this family. We have never had to turn a family away without being able to give them a significant amount of food. So we're very blessed that way. I cannot even imagine having to turn someone away and not have food for them. That would just, I can't even imagine that.
Watch over this precious, precious.
But food bank officials say they expect California families to go through harder times before it gets any better.
During these really tough times, Lord, they have a
for the California Report, this is Sandy Tolan.
That story was co-reported by Diane DeGuzman. Next week, our series continues with a look at the food stamp program. It was designed to help those who can't afford their next meal, but many Californians who fit that description aren't getting the help they need. You'll find the entire series at hungerinthegoldenstate.com. We've also got a link on our website. It's californiareport.org. From the economy to politics, California has been a bellwether for shifts in American life. In his latest book, Model Home, Los Angeles novelist Eric Puchner delves into the state's recent past and finds a spiritual malaise all too familiar today. Oscar Villalone has this review.
What's the worst that can happen to an upwardly mobile, college-educated white American? The question looms large in Eric Puchner's funny yet sobering first novel, Model Home. Set mostly in mid-80s idyllic Palos Verdes in a toxic desert somewhere in the outskirts of the Antelope Valley, Puchner's tale is on one level a nuanced exploration of many engrossing contemporary themes, the distressingly easy ways close families can dissolve, the hairline fractures of weakness that privilege and youth can tragically mask, and the complex strata composing Southern California society and the common bonds among them. But Puckner, who was deservedly lauded for his first book, the story collection Music Through the Floor, has done something artistically profitable by unobtrusively framing his narrative within that big question. So as we witness the undoing of the Zillers, Wisconsin transplants whose vulnerabilities are exquisitely, comically, and painfully laid bare. For Warren Ziller, the dream bears an awful lot of resemblance to what it might have been a couple of years before our Great Recession. Leave an already comfortable existence for sun and coast Southern California and make a bundle in a can't-miss business which will pay for the back-breaking mortgage on a big house in a gated community. For his good-hearted, unpretentious wife, Camille, and their adolescent children, it's about making their way and finding their identity within that bubble of ever-striving. It's not a life without its stresses and risks, and in the first part of the book, we grow to care deeply about their problems. Much of this has to do with Puckner's technical gifts. He's greatly skilled in immersing us in the mental and physical state of his characters, allowing us to inhabit their skin, sometimes literally, and he can find the poetic in the mundane, as when he describes an outing to the beach. She watched Shannon slather herself in Hawaiian Tropic and then rub it into her skin, working slowly down her body. Chest, stomach, legs, greasing each part to a buttery shine before moving to the next. It was like watching someone turn blissfully into glass. But it's when Puckner pops that voluptuous bubble that an already entertaining, thoughtful novel gets much better. Misfortune chases the Zillers from paradise to the middle of nowhere, where they find themselves living next to a sulfurous sludge pond. Isolated from the world they once knew, their lives are fast-tracked to eternally working in a video store or selling knives door-to-door. For the children, effortlessly popular Dustin, sulky scathing Lyle, and weirdly precocious Jonas, the certainty of going to college or keeping old friends has vanished. And for one of them, a life of physical challenges and ostracizing scars is an almost given. Meanwhile, Warren and Camille's marriage is barreling toward a waterfall, and with it, the love and the stability, spiritual and financial, we all need like oxygen. Model Home is smart enough to see the dark humor in all of this. As it turns out, the worst that can happen to the Zillers is to live like a lot of the people around them, with little material comfort and a small safety net, with battered psyches and fragile futures, but lives imminently capable of dignity, love, and hope. It's a reality most of the world would still call a dream worth aspiring to.
Oscar Villalone reviews books for NPR.org and others. He reviewed Model Home by Eric Puckner. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman. Our interns are Caitlin Esch, Jennifer Bidas, Kelly Mahan, Julia Simon, and Tracy Sharman. She helped produce our story about military teens. Rob Schmitz is the editor of the Hunger in the Golden State series. Gabriel Cohen is our online editor. The producer is Victoria Maleone. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, sponsor of calqualitycare.org, a new online guide to long-term care in California. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URScorp.com.